This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
Let's go to Los Angeles. ESPN Los Angeles' Dave McMenamin is with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. He flies by after the Lakers really reestablished themselves last night. What was the difference, Dave? Why were they so effective inside last night with Gasol and Bynum where they had not been in the games in Oklahoma City?
Well, fellas, they got back to what they did in Game 1. It was a consistent beating of the post from the first quarter on and really great post-passing between Powell and Bynum, being able to draw defenders and still find each other. Derek Fisher likened it to like playing volleyball above everybody else's hands because they're so long. They're both 7 feet, and the Thunder front line can't handle that.
Is their inconsistency their own fault?
Oh, of course it is, Mike. I mean, look at it. They found something that worked, though. That's what matters. It took 5 games to get there, but, you know, Kobe Bryant, for however healthy he is or unhealthy for that matter, he decided to take on the challenge of guarding Russell Westbrook, and that certainly worked. I mean, look at Russell Westbrook, 4-for-13 last night, 15 points when he had been averaging 21 points for the series and shooting well over 50%. I mean, that was a virtuoso performance for Kobe Bryant, despite only scoring 13 points.
You know, sometimes great teams, Rick Bucher was talking about this before, they sort of put it on cruise control until they need it. Do the Lakers have the ability to do that enough to win another championship this year?
I think they can. I think they don't want to fall into the same hole that they dug themselves into early on in this series. At some point, you got to learn your lesson or you're going to get punched in the mouth. I mean, if they pull something like this, should they make it to the finals against a team like Cleveland or Orlando, I think right now are playing better basketball than anybody else in the league, that's going to be a problem. If they can sustain this and build upon this and enter into the finals with everybody healthy and everybody clicking the way they did last night, there's certainly no reason why you're not going to say that they have a great shot at defending this championship.
Great stuff, Dave. We appreciate you jumping in. We'll talk to you in the next few days. Dave McMenamin with us from ESPNLosAngeles.com.
To compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place, visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
Joining us now in studio with some surprising post-game reaction is 710 ESPN reporter Beto Duran. Beto covers the Lakers, travels with them in the playoffs. And I think the big moment of the night, this game was such a blowout, Beto. I saw on your Twitter account that during action in the third quarter, it was such a big blowout when the Lakers were up by 30, they showed Dustin Hoffman on the kiss cam during action. While the game was going on, Dustin Hoffman on the kiss cam during the game?
Dustin Hoffman rules kiss cam. During the regular season, they'll show people during the kiss cam, and next thing you know, they always finish on Hoffman when he's there. If Rayman's in the building, he always gets the last one because he'll either kiss who he's next to, or he'll put on a little skit. It's always funny with Dustin Hoffman. Today, they did the kiss cam about the second quarter. Game was... And it was a blowout by then. And
nothing, and then
exactly.
It was over.
But they didn't find Hoffman in that one. So the third quarter comes around, they show Hoffman. He didn't realize that he was on the kiss cam. He was looking down. By the time he realized, the action was starting. So they kept it on him. Hoffman said, all right, puts his hands up, grabs the girl next to him, gives her a kiss. Action is going on. Everybody.
Well, yeah. Oh, you mean action on the court. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, no, actually, there was more action with Dustin Hoffman than there was on the court. But
yeah.
The game is being played, and 10 people are running around the court, 18-9-9-7, loving Dustin Hoffman. I was watching him. It was a good time. That's how bad a game it got in the second half.
That's Los Angeles for you. Oh, we got to have something else. The game is not enough. We got somebody doing something crazy in the stands. Hey, show Dustin Hoffman. He'll kiss somebody.
Exactly. I mean, he's a fan favorite.
Now, I know you spent some time in the Thunder locker room after the game was over. They had a lot of confidence going into this game after losing Game 4. Oh, what were they like after the game, after getting drilled the way they did?
You know, this one team, I've said it before, and I was telling our local host here that, you know, Oklahoma City, the team, before the first game, they didn't come in like they were the 8th seed, wide-eyed and scared. They didn't look like Bambi on ice. You know, they were a team that thought they had a chance. They came in, and they gave the Lakers a good run. Yet today, leaving the locker room, Russell Westbrook said, we go back to Oklahoma City, why would we be demoralized? He goes, we still have a chance in the series. He goes, all we need is another victory, and we're even, right? And he looked around, we're like, Yeah. You don't sound like a team that's young. You're giving us good veteran cliches. Love that when they give veteran cliches. And, you know, James Harden, a guy who's a rookie. Last year he was playing in the Pac-10 tournament at Staples Center. Now he's going up against Kobe Bryant. He said, things are different in Oklahoma City. Why should we be scared of going against the Lakers there? And you get that attitude from the players. They believe it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're too young to know any better. They're too young to know that their backs are against the wall, that this could possibly be their last game, and I think they're going to come out and give them a fight. And Harden even went on and said, he goes, we've lost big before during the regular season. He goes, we've always bounced back. Why wouldn't we now?
Now, as far as Russell Westbrook goes, it was quite a different experience for him tonight. Ooh. Kobe Bryant on him for the majority of the game, at least through the first half. Turned the ball over 8 times. He shot 4 for 13 for the game. Artest did a nice job on Kevin Durant, but Durant still, I think, got 17 or 18 points. But Westbrook had a brutal night, many turnovers. What did he have to say about Kobe Bryant guarding him after the game?
He started off early. He went 1 for 5 in that first quarter, 3 points, and he just didn't look comfortable. And I think that's exactly what the Lakers wanted by putting Kobe Bryant on him. Westbrook was asked, did he expect Kobe to come after him in the first quarter? He goes, yeah, kind of, sort of. And we're like, well, did you expect? He goes, yeah, I knew they were going to change it up. They're not going to let me do what I was doing the first four games. And he said it's all his fault that the reason Oklahoma City didn't come out and play well in the first quarter. He goes, I should have done a better job of adjusting to Kobe Bryant guarding me than I really did. He goes, now that I know that they're going to use his game plan, he goes, give me a couple of days to watch some videotape of what happened. He goes, I'm not making the same mistakes.
Well, I don't know that that's exactly what the Lakers are going to do. I don't know that you can put Kobe on you can't put Kobe on somebody like that every game. He's going to wear out, you know, in a week and a half. They're going to do it when they need to. And so now they're going to adjust. It's going to be a different look in Oklahoma City. But if the Lakers come out in game six like they came out tonight, doesn't matter where the game's being played, the game could be played on the moon, because the Thunder can't match up with the Lakers when it comes to being able to control the paint down low. What did the Lakers do tonight? They came out and it was Gasol and it was Bynum down low and it was 10-0, and you may as well have stopped the game right there. If the Lakers can do that, then there's not a lot of teams that can hang with them.
And that's the problem we've had since day one with the Lakers this season. It's which team is going to show up? Which team is going to turn on the switch today? I went in that locker room. There's not a switch in there. They're not just going to...
There's no switch?
There's no switch.
Are you looking for the switch?
After today's game?
It would be pretty funny. Excuse me, before we start, Kobe and Pat, I'm looking for the switch to hit, so you guys, can you tell me where the switch is?
All these fans that call in the post game and they call in our shows throughout the day, and they go and say, there's no switch. You know, I was looking, I didn't find one, and there's not one in Oklahoma City's either, but the Lakers, you're right, if they come out and play this way on Friday, the series is over. I think the series is over just by the way they came out and completely laid it to Oklahoma City today. And I think that's really going to be the effect. Would I be surprised if the Lakers came in on Friday and laid an egg? No, because this team has been so erratic, so bipolar, that you don't know what you're going to get. I think the next couple of days is a telltale sign of the Lakers when they're at practice, how they react. And we won't know how they are until about Thursday before they jump on the plane. That's when I have a better idea. And I hate saying that, because Laker fans, they want an answer. They want to know how come this team can't play this way every single night. You know what? I don't know. And you know what? I don't think the Lakers know either.
710 ESPN travels with the Los Angeles Lakers, Beto Duran. Beto, thanks for stopping by in studio, and thanks for bringing your special Lakers megaphone that they handed out to the fans tonight because they wanted to make more noise.
And that's one thing. I've never heard a Laker player say, hey, we want our fans to support us. We want our fans to be loud. This is what Andrew Bynum and some of the other players were saying before Game 5. You know, they went to Oklahoma City. It was a loud barn, and then they come back. That's a hockey term, right? The barn. You know,
the barn, yeah. St. Louis was the barn, yeah, for a long
exactly.
time.
Exactly. Well, you know, it was a loud barn in Oklahoma City, and players were saying we wanted the crowd to be fired up. Well, the Laker fans came out, and they were loud, and get this, Jason, they showed up early.
They did. I was extremely impressed with the crowd. They were there early. They were into the game from the tip-off. Then they all left in the middle of the third quarter, but the Lakers were up by 30, exactly. So I could understand wanting to beat the traffic. But when they needed them, they were there. Beginning of the game was a different Laker crowd. I agree.
And the nieces that were there with their rich uncles?
Yes.
Down low? Even they were excited. Their $300 jeans were getting out of the expensive seats.
Beto, I appreciate it. Let me know if you're going to be on Kiss Cam with Dustin Hoffman.
A man of the people.
Joining us now is ESPN The Magazine senior NBA writer Rick Bucher. And Rick, if LeBron's elbow is as bad as it is to make him shoot free throws left-handed, what does this mean for the rest of the Eastern Conference playoffs?
Man, it changes everything. And it's why, you know, when we prognosticate, and this year more than anything, prognosticating and not keeping in consideration that injuries and health are such a huge, huge factor But I got to tell you, Jason, the reason that I thought this was the year for the Cavs and for LeBron to finally win one is because I looked at them and I said, they have got the youngest superstar. They've got the healthiest superstar. And it just goes to show you, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, if he can't shoot right-handed, then that changes everything. And it brings us to, I mean, I don't know that as good as LeBron is, I don't know that we're going to see, you know, the magic filling in for center for Kareem, where he changes his entire game and he plays on the post and scores left-handed. I don't know that that is in LeBron's wheelhouse. And without him not being 100%, even as good a passer as he is, this, you know, I'm sure the Boston Celtics' ears perked up when they heard this, and it will make things very, very intriguing.
Oh, I think right now, Doc Rivers, it's like Cobra Kai at the end of Karate Kid. Sweep the leg. Sweep the leg. You hammer LeBron on that elbow when he comes down in the paint.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's interesting because looking at the Lakers tonight, it's don't underestimate teams that have been there, and particularly the older teams. And I've said this before, and I look, they know how long this is. They know that to win what they're after, they have to go into June. So when they don't look right in March or April, and you question their effort and their intensity, hey, it's simply because that you can't convince them that playing the Kings on March 22nd is vital to winning a championship. Now, you make them 2-2 against the Oklahoma City Thunder, and you're going to see what they're made of. If you put them up against a hot Miami Heat team and they realize, look, we got the Cavs coming up, we can't mess around, you're going to get a five-game series, and you're going to see effort that you haven't seen before. And that's why, you know, to taking how a team is playing down the stretch. Look, if they're a championship season team and they're playing great, well, that's a great sign. But if they're a young team and they're playing great down the stretch, they still haven't seen the playoffs. They still don't know what that's about, and it doesn't mean that they're not going to get chewed up by a championship team when it decides, hey, we need to give it our best.
All right, Rick, let's just say, for instance, that obviously if LeBron can't shoot and he's got to play lefty, that's going to be doom and gloom for the Cavaliers. But let's just say he's a little bit better than he was shooting lefty free throws tonight, but he's still really banged up going into the series, which is kind of where we think he's going to be. How does this change your outlook for just this series between the Cavaliers and the Celtics?
I thought that the Celtics would have a fighting chance no matter what. If LeBron James is not 100%, then I like the Celtics coming out of that series. Where are we going to put? We're putting him at 75%, 80%. You know, at the end of the day, when the Cavaliers play a great team, as much as they got all sorts of help from different places against the Bulls, the bottom line is when they play a great defensive team, it's still going to end up with putting the ball in LeBron's hands at the end of games to win what would be expected to be close games. And if he can't, if he doesn't have his full arsenal, I don't like their chances.
ESPN The Magazine senior NBA writer Rick Bucher is with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Rick, let's head to the Western Conference now, where it looked like the Lakers were interested for a little while, at least on Tuesday night, blowing out the Oklahoma City Thunder, taking a 3-2 lead there. All the Lakers' problems, Kobe's not shooting, he's shooting too much, the Lakers are getting to the free throw line, they're not getting to the free throw line. I think we saw the real Lakers on Tuesday night.
No question about it. And what they, you know, I figured that the one thing that they needed to do was, you know, Kevin Durant is going to get his. And you can live with that. Much like Boston kind of let Dwayne Wade go and just said, we're not going to let anybody else get it done. Well, they took the same tact in terms of, okay, Kevin Durant, great player, really sort of unstoppable in a lot of ways. We'll make him work for what he gets. But the guy that we really can't let get off, the second guy, that's Russell Westbrook. If he gets off, he's going to get in transition. Then he's not just scoring, but he's getting some of the ancillary players going. And they clearly they made a committed effort to take him out of his game, and that's changed everything. Now, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether they can maintain this through Oklahoma City or whether we're going to go to a game seven. But the Lakers demonstrated everything that they wanted to demonstrate, not just winning, but saying, you know, I feel like they awakened the lion with the beatdown in Oklahoma City. I mean, I don't know that you would have gotten this performance if it had been like a three-point win. You know, if it had been a close win, I think the Lakers would have come in and said, okay, we're back on our home court. We gave another one away, but we'll be okay. But they were embarrassed in Oklahoma City, and they decided to do the same. And the fact that they came back and did exactly that, this has to put the Oklahoma City Thunder back on their heels a little bit. And the one other thing I got to add here is the fact that, you know, no matter how a team plays, and we saw it with the Hornets a couple years ago going up against San Antonio, it's a funny thing. They played so well during that series. They went into Game 7, and I said, wow, I got to take the Hornets. They're the better team in this series. But there's a weird thing that happens when a young team suddenly realizes, oh my gosh, we could close out this series. It's not that closeout game is just a different. The playoffs are different from the regular season, and then a closeout game goes yet to another level. And if you've never been there, it's just you don't know how to operate. And the Lakers have been there many, 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 many times. This young Thunder team will be there in the future. But this was their first taste, and they did what young teams usually do. They blinked.
Now, as far as the Lakers go, Rick, I think one thing you did see, to your point on Russell Westbrook, was Kobe Bryant on him almost exclusively, at least through the first half of the game, when Westbrook was awful. He started out with 8 turnovers and 7 points, didn't shoot the ball well at all. Yep. I think this is what you're going to see from the Lakers the rest of the way. They don't have anybody to guard the point guards that are left in the West, whether it's Steve Nash or Andre Miller, whoever they want, Tony Parker. I think you're going to see Kobe taking on a bigger defensive onus as the playoffs go on.
This you could be right. The difficulty there, obviously, is can you have him do that, and then can you have him with fresh legs in the fourth quarter when you need to win close games? You know, they took the approach that, hey, look, if we can step on them early, this is the Oklahoma City Thunder. If we can get up on them early, they're not coming back on us because they've never been here before. I don't know that you can do that against the top teams, and if you're in a close game and Kobe doesn't have his legs down the stretch, now you've rolled the dice in a tricky way. And I'll go back. This is why, from the beginning, I did not like the letting Trevor Ariza go and getting Ron Artest. Yes, Ron Artest is probably a better matchup for a Carmelo Anthony, potentially, or a LeBron James or Paul Pierce. But the problem is that Derek Fisher has gotten old. Jordan Farmar is not ready. And so you're left with Kobe Bryant having to take the most difficult perimeter assignments. Trevor Ariza could do that.
He's ESPN The Magazine senior NBA writer Rick Bucher. Rick, as always, appreciate your time with us on All Night. We'll talk to you next week.
Well, I've been saying it. I love the Celtics, I love the Spurs, and I love the Lakers this year. It's the year of the old guy. I don't think the young teams, the Portlands and the Oklahoma Cities, are good enough yet. And I still think the old veterans have one more punch. I love the Spurs, and it's just, you know, I always told you, I love Larry King, I love Supreme Court justices, I like old people. Now, Steve Nash is going to be offended by that, but you're a veteran, Steve, and I got to tell you, you veteran players in the playoffs, I always lean on you. Is intelligence underrated, Steve, when playoff basketball arrives?
Well, if it is, it shouldn't be. You know, I think whenever you see a team win a championship or get close to that level, there's always a great amount of intelligence to their squad. So, I mean, we've seen it over the years with San Antonio, certainly. And I think last year the Lakers team was a really intelligent team. I don't underrate it. If people do, I think that's really a big mistake because I think it's paramount for any team to get to the top.
You know, Steve, what's interesting is people have said about Kobe sometimes he takes quarters off or halves off, and he's played a lot of games, and so have you. You know, it seems to me Kobe knows he's got only so many 99-mile-an-hour fastballs left. How do you condition your body or work around your body knowing that it's aging? And, you know, as you get older, everybody's got limitations. How do you do it with yourself, Steve?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, a long career of experience, learning about myself, about my body, about what it takes to get through our season. You know, I think it's always evolving and changing. And so, you know, I'm at a place now where I think sometimes you're just so much more efficient in your work ethic, your understanding that you can do a little bit less and do more in doing so just because you're more educated and will have a better understanding. So, you know, I try to, you know, never overdo it, but at the same time, you know, work as hard as I can with you know, with the parameters I've set without going over that edge where, you know, I've done damage to my ability to keep playing for my team. So, you know, it's really something that's been measured and grown and evolved throughout my career.
Two-time MVP Steve Nash, Suns up 3-2 in the Blazers, Thursday night, Game 6. Somebody told me you really, and it's interesting because this stuff fascinates me, and you've always been a very conscientious, smart, out-of-the-box thinker. You're a big sleep guy, that you had some theories on sleep. Can you share those? I heard this the other day. I hope I'm not burying you, but you have some sleep theories or the importance of it?
Yeah, I mean, I it's things I've read and I believe in. I just think that we generally, you know, we live such fast-paced lives, whether you're an athlete or whatever your profession is, you know, in this part of the world, that, you know, we do neglect sleep and we are all sleep-deprived. So I think that, you know, if you look at kind of the, without sounding like you're at an ad seminar, but with the three pillars of health, you know, there'd probably be sleep, nutrition, and exercise. So, you know, I think many times we just gloss right over the sleep part. You know, we're all into the nutrition or the exercise or whatever it may be, but we don't pay attention to what our body really needs to recover. And the most basic fundamental of that is sleep. So it's really simple. It's just a matter of prioritizing it, you know, more than anything. If you understand what sleep, the benefits of sleep do for you, then you just have to prioritize it. We've been running around here, you know, so fast for so long that that can be difficult. So for me, the biggest thing has just been to, you know, make it a priority, turn off the TV, put down the book, whatever it is, find time every day to get a nap if you can, and just try to get your sleep at night.
By the way, LeBron James, a believer in the Steve Nash theory, has said before, 10, 12 hours, wants a two-hour nap, even in high school. Steve, it's funny. I really think, I just love the Celtics. Old veterans, cagey, cranky old guys. I think they give Cleveland big issues. You've played the Cavs. You've played the Celtics. Any feeling on that, a veteran team against a younger team?
Well, you never really want to count the old team out, that's for sure. I mean, I think, you know, the Cavs are a phenomenal team this year. LeBron is turning into one of the greatest players ever to play the game and can have such an impact on a game or a series that, you know, even that is unforeseen. You know, who knows what he could do in a series? So when, you know, goaded into a performance that, you know, we'll never forget. But having said that, you know, the Celtics, like you said, they're just tough and smart and they've been there before and they'll take things away that maybe a younger, more athletic team wouldn't realize to take away. You know, and so I think, you know, I don't know if they can beat the Cavs if they met, you know, when they play, but I would never want to bet against a team with that much intelligence, heart, understanding, and those guys have done it before together. So I think there's got to be a wealth of confidence somewhere inside there, no matter how many struggles they have this year.
Would you ever take a charge from LeBron James?
You know, I probably am stupid enough to do that in the heat of the moment, but you know, not a wise thing. I mean, this guy is a locomotive, so he's he's just fantastic for our game. Such an athlete, but such a feel for the game on top of all that it's a. That's a pleasure to have him as a colleague.
Suns up 3-2 in the Blazers, Thursday game 6. You are an absolute credit to the game, a blast to watch. Good luck to you. I'm going to ask you one more. I'm hearing all this in 3 years, Kevin Durant's going to be the best player in the league. Okay, 3 years from now, Steve Nash, who's the best player in this league?
I think LeBron's still the best player in the league, but Kevin Durant's going to be a top three or four player, no question. I mean, he's just got the dimensions, athleticism, love for the game, coupled with just an uncanny ability at his size and length to shoot the ball. He's just, you know, it's just inevitable that he's just going to continue to evolve and be fantastic. But I don't see, you know, how anyone could say that someone's going to, that's playing in our game right now is going to be better than LeBron in 3 or 4 years just because of what he brings to the table. I mean, it's just,
not only can he score the ball at the same rate, basically, as Kevin, but he's such an incredible all-court player, passer, leader, winner, strength, durability. I mean, there's just so many elements that go into it that it's almost unfair to compare him to anybody.
Well, another Canadian we'd like to claim as our own, Steve Nash. Congratulations with your career. Thanks again, Steve.
You got it. Thanks, Colin.
Meanwhile, Mike, I personally think that Dwight Howard is the best big man in basketball. It's not an opinion. I think it's a statement of fact at this point. But I don't know that he's handling this well. He got in a lot of foul trouble in their series with Charlotte, fouled out of two of the four games, was really a non-factor because of foul trouble through most of that series. And they will need him to be a whole lot more a factor if they're going to go as deep into this thing as they want to.
Right.
Well, now he's written on DwightHoward.com the following. You all know that that series against Charlotte drove me crazy. I mean, it was almost comical at times how I was getting fouls called on me. There was nothing I could do out there, and I felt like I couldn't move without getting that whistle blown on me. I'm not looking to say anything to get myself in trouble with the league, but I just don't see other star players getting called for fouls the way I get them. No star player in the league is out of games the way I am. I even talked to Patrick Ewing about his career, and he said he never had foul trouble like what I'm going through. I've got to say this is the most frustrating stretch of my career. I've never been through four games in a row like that, but hey, we won the series, and we're moving on. Clearly, he is frustrated, but when you put more of a spotlight on yourself with this now, in some way, I think that could wind up hurting you with the officials and calls going forward.
I think it could as well. You know, Legs was in here and saying that he thinks that, Howard got ripped off on a few of the calls, but he still got the calls on him. You know, averaged 3.5 fouls a game during the regular season, now 5.5 fouls a game in the playoffs, fouled out of two of the four, was in foul trouble in the other two. So if the refs are going to call it a certain way, he's going to have to adjust on the court.
I wanted to get this guy's perspective. Let's bring in Nick Anderson on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. He flies by with us here. He is the Magic's all-time leader in points and steals and games and minutes, and he's still very connected to the organization. And, Nick, good morning. And I remember you and I were chatting at ESPN the weekend a few months ago, and you were going really effusive in your praise of Dwight Howard and where you think his potential is. So at this point, as you watch what happened in that series, what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, he has to stop griping at the officials and just play basketball and not worry about anything else. I never seen an official make a call and then three or four plays later, I decided to change my mind. So just play the game and adjust. The officials adjust to the way players play, and the players adjust to the way officiating is being called. So that's the first thing. And secondly, you have to understand that, Dwight, you can't block every shot. I know Superman is a fiction and is not a fact. Don't try to block every shot. And that's what he tries to do. He tries to, you know, just control the middle, which you want him to do. But you have to pick and choose, you know, your chances. And at this point, he doesn't do that.
How does his game need to develop overall to keep him out of foul trouble?
Well, he has to know when he can go and try to block a shot. Sometimes you can be overly aggressive on things that you're trying to do. And that's what I see a lot of times. For one instance, against Nazi Muhammad went up to shoot the ball, and Dwight gave him the little nudge and then try to block the shot. You can't do that. You know, you're more athletic. Your jumping ability is outstanding for your size. So, you know, use that to your advantage. Sometimes I don't think he used his athleticism to his advantage.
He is so gifted athletically. We're with Nick Anderson here quickly, Mike and Mike in the Morning. I just wanted you to share, if you would, with our audience what we were talking about and just your thoughts on his potential. Because, of course, you were there in Orlando when they first drafted Shaquille O'Neal and he came into the league. And now you have watched Dwight Howard in his early developmental period. What do you make of the ceiling for Dwight Howard?
Well, the sky's the limit for him. Yeah, there's obvious there's a whole lot of things that he needs to work on, and the main thing is the free throw shooting, which to me, it's not his mechanics. I went through the free throw woos. It's all a mental aspect with Dwight Howard. It's mental with him, and if he can control the mental part of that, he'll be just fine. I'm looking for him to start developing the little 16, 17 foot jump shot to open his game up. So, you know, the big guys have to play him honest, get that Tim Duncan his outside shot with the power that he possesses in the paint and going right up over you and dunking on you. So I've seen a lot of development. He's come across the middle with the little Patrick Ewing hook shot. The baseline move to the baseline with the left hand. So there's a lot of development that Dwight has come a long way with, but I still think he has a ways to go.
Excellent insight, and it was really fun seeing you down there. Thanks for jumping in for a few minutes, Nick. We always appreciate it.
All right, Jim. Y'all have a good one.
Take care. Nick. It's Nick Anderson now working in the front office with the Orlando Magic and has that perspective.
ESPN.com baseball insider Keith Law was on ESPN News yesterday and said, you know what? Without being silly, you can easily say Pujols is worth $50 million a year. A fact that Braves manager Bobby Cox seemed to echo on Tuesday night when he said, look, he's twice as good as any player in Major League Baseball, so $50 million for Albert Pujols. Joining us now via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline is Keith Law. And Keith, congratulations. I think Bobby Cox got his take from you. So I believe what, $50 million is the starting point for Pujols negotiations?
You know, you're probably not going to ask for $50 million, although I don't think that would be out of line when you consider how overpaid Howard is by the Phillies. If you're asking the Cardinals to overpay you by a similar margin, then yes, Pujols would probably be worth $50 million. But I think Pujols would be completely justified in going to the Cardinals or eventually going to the market and saying, I think I'm worth $30 million. I mean, he is a substantially better player than Howard, a better hitter, a more complete hitter, and a better defensive first baseman. I think he'd be justified in saying, I want $30 million. The problem, essentially, with this Howard contract is that unless executives across the league just sort of uniformly say, this is just a bad contract and we're going to ignore it, we're not going to let this reset the market, you're going to have agents for Pujols, Fielder, Adrian Gonzalez, all superior players to Howard at this particular point in time, going to their respective clubs about to talk contract extension and saying, we're better than Howard, we want more money than he got. Now, they may not necessarily want 5 years, they may want more years, they may want fewer years, but whatever it is, that average annual value of $25 million is going to be a sticking point in a lot of negotiations. And I could certainly see Cardinal fans, especially Brewer fans, being upset because it does seem to decrease the likelihood, especially for Fielder, of the club keeping the player. Maybe in the case of Pujols, it's just more that it got more expensive for the Cardinals to keep him, because I still find it hard to imagine him in another uniform. But no matter how it shakes out, it got a lot tougher because the Phillies gave out this exorbitant deal.
Now, I see the way the deal is structured. I can see your point, because it's between $20 and $25 million a year. There are no escalators, no, we're saving money on the front end of this. It's $20-$25 million a year by the time Howard turns 36, 37 years old. But as far as production, I think it's really tough for people to argue and say, here's a guy that averages between 45 and 50 home runs a year and between 140 and 150 RBIs, and he hits about 260, 270.
You've got to throw out the RBIs, right? Because that's Chase Utley. Utley is largely responsible for the fact that Howard gets so many RBIs, because Utley is on base about 40% of the time in front of Howard. You could put any decent power hitter behind Chase Utley, and he'd rack up a big RBI total. Howard's problems, and I'm not saying he's a bad hitter at all, but Howard is the second highest paid player in baseball under this deal, and he's not the second best player in baseball or the 10th best, and I don't even think he's one of the 20 best players in baseball. He's a good power hitter, especially he destroys right-handed pitching. Against left-handed pitching, he's not very good. His on-base percentages are headed in the wrong direction. His contact rates are not great. So if he experiences any kind of loss of bat speed, which I think is likely, it happens to just about every hitter when he gets to his 30s, Howard's overall offensive value is going to drop fairly quickly. And I think, you know, Howard is not a $25 million player now, but what really concerns me about the deal is that it essentially assumes that he's going to be better over the next 5 years than he was last year or the year before. And we know from the history of watching 30-plus-year-old sluggers age that that's not likely to happen. Most hitters, even outstanding ones, do show signs of decline in their 30s. And even if Howard declines at a relatively slow rate, he's not going to get close to that salary in terms of the value he produces on the field.
ESPN.com baseball insider Keith Law is with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Now, so hang on a second, Keith. If this is due to Chase Utley, if you put Ryan Howard in a middle-of-the-road offensively talented team, not the worst, but not a team that can manufacture runs like Philadelphia, middle of the pack, what are his home runs and RBIs?
His RBIs are going to be lower. RBIs are largely a function of who hits in front of you in the lineup. More than anything else, that's really what determines what your RBI total is. That and just luck, too. The guys have to get on base in front of you, and then your, you know, the balls that you put into play. I mean, obviously, you hit a ball out like Howard does. That's a different story. But, you know, everything.
Right, but what is he? Does he drop to like 120? Does he drop to 100? What does he drop to?
It depends on who's hitting in front of him. It really does. I mean, you're talking about a guy getting on base in front of him, what, 50 fewer times a year? If you drop it, if the guy in front of him has a 330, 340 on base percentage, it's a pretty significant difference. This is why I don't use RBIs. I mean, really, I could not tell you who led the league in RBIs last year. And most front offices today, the ones that at least employ any kind of statistical analysis, they don't look at RBIs because they understand that they're useless. They don't tell you anything about how an individual player performed. Runs really matter on a team level. But on an individual level, runs scored and RBIs, you require other teammates to rack up those stats. And so they're not really meaningful measures of what the individual player did.
All right, Keith, now you talked about RBIs and players are going to devalue and they're going to hit less and when they turn 30. Pujols is 30. He's going to get his new contract on the right side of 30, and I mean on the upper side of 30. What do you expect to see his numbers do the next few years?
I think he'll decline as well. I expect him to decline more slowly than Howard. Howard's, one, we've already seen the signs of decline, especially in Howard's performance against left-handed pitching, which has not been good the last couple of years. The numbers haven't been good, and he hasn't looked good. You know, Howard is a mediocre defensive first baseman. He's improved, but he's not very good. Pujols is a plus defender at first by just about any standard. And one of the things that we know historically is that players who produce more, who have more defensive value, do as a class tend to age better than players who have no defensive value or actually have negative defensive value. And so that's part of why I'm fairly bearish on Howard aging well through over the course of this deal, but slightly more optimistic on Pujols aging well. Now, Pujols is going to decline, absolutely. And frankly, if Pujols comes to me and I own the Cardinals and he says I want $32 million a year, you got to swallow hard, but probably say no, simply because it's not likely that Pujols, who has been extremely productive, is going to be that productive over the course of, say, a seven-year deal, which is what he's likely to be looking for. But if you told me I had to pick one of those two guys and give him a 5 to 7 year deal at $25 to $30 million per, I would absolutely take Pujols over Howard because I think there are a handful of factors that tell me he will age better. He will maintain his level of offensive production better over the course of a long deal.
We have to start with the hottest team in baseball here, well, especially since it's the Mets. Six in a row, beneficiary of some surprising starting pitching. Mike Pelfrey's been unhittable, but they're also getting it from some other guys down the rotation. Nobody saw this coming, so are the Mets just off to a good start, or can they keep up something that at least closely resembles what they're doing right now?
I think it's more of a nice start for the Mets than that they're a legitimate challenge to the Phillies. I think the Phillies are still pretty clearly the best team in that division, at least on paper. What's interesting about what the Mets have done so far is that Mike Pelfrey, ninth overall pick in 2005, looks like he's finally starting to turn that corner. Not quite in the way that I expected. I expected to see him, I always thought he'd be kind of a ground ball machine. Even in college, he was an extreme ground baller. Big fastball, big guy, really got on top of the ball. Good downhill plane, generated a lot of ground balls. Last couple of starts, he hasn't necessarily been a big ground baller, but locating a lot better than he had in the past, not walking as many guys as he had in the past. Do I think he's going to put up a zero ERA this year? No, it's probably not likely, but could he step in and be that number two starter that they've been looking for behind Johan Santana? Well, he's certainly the best candidate on that staff, and I think the one guy of all the non-Johan pitchers likely to actually sustain this success over the course of the season.
Well, I think you're right. If he does have a zero ERA the rest of the season, the Mets will stay in it for a little while, I think.
True. I can't really argue with that. And he might actually get some Cy Young votes.
ESPN.com baseball insider Keith Law is with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. And Keith, my dad's lived in Syracuse now for the last, 30, 40 years. After Steven Strasburg started Double A Harrisburg, he pitched for six innings and he pitched five no-hit innings in his fourth start. He struck out six guys, just one batter reached base, and that was on a dropped third strike where he went to first base. Is it okay to tell my dad to go get his tickets at Syracuse to see Steven Strasburg in Triple A for his next start?
I don't know, because this really isn't about Strasburg passing some Double A test. The Nationals have said that there are specific mechanical issues they would like him to work on, and I know that they would like to see him continue to refine his changeup. But it's also about, I think, keeping Strasburg in the minors for a while to manage his innings load over the course of the season and potentially to control his service time, maybe hold him down to the middle of June so that he doesn't become a Super 2 player, thus become eligible for arbitration a year sooner. He could do all of those things that they want him to do, and he could continue to work in the minors, not rack up big league service time in Double A, as well as he could in Triple A. And in Double A, in Triple A, he'll face some guys with big league experience. He'll face some older hitters. There's an advantage to that. But in Double A, he'll probably face more legitimate top prospects. So I could see a compelling argument to just leave him in Double A until he's recalled. He might just pitch in the Eastern League until the middle of June and then jump straight to the majors.
Now, and we are going to see him by then, right?
I think so. I can't predict exactly what the Nationals are going to do. I find it hard to imagine. He's going to tear up whatever league he's in, right? We're seeing him start to show signs of dominating the Eastern League. I think if they put him in AAA, they'd have the same results. This guy's got stuff that's just going to miss minor league bats at any level. He needs to get to the major leagues at some point this year just to be challenged. There are things he's going to have to work on that he's only going to be able to work on in the big leagues. Maybe they call him up in July. Maybe they call him up at the end of May. I mean, maybe they hold him down for the rest of the season. I think that's counterproductive. I have to imagine he's up in the big leagues for at least half of the 2010 season. And if I was running the show there, I would certainly have him up by the middle of June, because holding him down past that point doesn't even achieve any service time ends. And you can manage his innings workload in the big leagues right under your nose just as well as you can manage it in Double A.
He's ESPN.com baseball insider Keith Law. Keith's latest on the front of the baseball page on ESPN.com. Keith, appreciate your time. We'll talk to you next week.
My pleasure.